Session number 10415, Rule 3.
George Chambers, Reel 3. How did the desert campaign progress then?
We went on from Benghazi, we moved up to the Marath line, where there was very heavy fighting. Eventually got through there. We got further on, and the scenery of course changed then. We got into Tunisia, and it became much more vegetation and much more growth.
Do you remember any particular incidents in the fighting at Marath or later?
No, not really. We then told that we were going back to Egypt, and we reached as far as Fidova, and then we were relieved by the 4th, I think it was the 4th or the 10th Indian Division. And we then got into our transport and drove the whole way. I think it took about 20 days or more down the road all the way to Alexandria, just outside of Alexandria, where we went into tented camp, and we then... we did an exercise up the Gulf of Aqaba as part of training for the invasion of Sicily. We were then went up this Gulf of Aqaba on the SS Danira, and we did exercises landing from the ship in LCAs, landing craft assault, being lured into the sea from the ship. And then we embarked in Alexandria. What's the top of the canal?
Doesn't matter.
Anyway, we embarked for Sicily, where we sailed across in a convoy. The most amazing sight when the first day when we came out on deck, the next morning after leaving Egypt, there was nothing to be seen except ships in the whole of the Mediterranean. There appeared to be hundreds of them, and this was the invasion. How were we ever, the Germans never spotted this, you can't imagine. However, the first worries when we got near towards Sicily, well, the rough seas, it was very windy, and very windy weather and wet. And the seas, the Mediterranean was very rough. I hadn't thought of.
What problems did that cause in getting into the LCAs?
Well, the trouble was, when you hit the bottom and you got down, you were lured on derricks down into the sea. But of course the sea was so rough that you hit the water, and then the next minute you were suspended again because the sea had gone down. And it was extremely difficult because you had the hooks on each end of the LCA, and if you unhooked one, this then swung about and flew around, and you had to get the hooks off as quickly as possible and push off away from the ship, otherwise you'd be decapitated by these things flying around. And that wasn't an easy job at all. Once you got yourself away, it wasn't so bad, but it was very rough. We were fortunate we'd had good maps of the landing beaches, so one recognized where you were and where you had to land, the point you had to go ashore. And the maps we'd had were very clear than our destination, so there wasn't any difficulty about that. But the crossing was once we were going in towards land, we were several hours in these boats, and it was extremely rough, and most of the people were useless. They were all lying in the bottom of the boat.
Seasickness,
yes, which was really, fortunately, I was just all right. But when you landed, you had to kick them off, people off, to get them up and get them out. Once they got onto the land, of course, they were all right, but they soon picked up, but they were
You weren't
useless.
In the first wave, were you?
Yes, we were in Sicily, yes.
You were under fire then, were you?
No, we were fairly... there was some long-distance shelling, and some shells were flying around, but not a lot. No, we had little opposition at that particular moment when we came. I think it was a complete surprise. So there we got ashore, and we went in without a great deal of opposition for the first few miles, and then it toughened up after that. We were then pushed on, and eventually we got up as far as Primicelli, but we had to march up there, and we were on the road, which was heavy going, and particularly in the heat. And we got us very near to Primicelli. It was then explained the plan was for the airborne division to come in, and parachutes were to land. Their object being to hold the bridge to prevent the Germans from blowing it up, so that we could then get across with transport. However, this didn't work because with the defences, aircraft defences of the Germans, who drove off the initial landings of the parachutes who were cast off, a lot of whom were landed in the sea and were never heard of again. Instead of being dropped where they should have been, they were dropped in the sea. However, we did run across the CO of one of the COs of a parachute regiment with some of his men who'd managed to get to the bridge, and they had found a ford across the river where we could get over, which we did. We got to the other side and held the bridge and prevented the Germans from blowing it up. Then ensured then the battle of the of Primicelli Bridge, because just up the road from the bridge there was a battalion of parachutists who had been dropped, the German parachutists who were in the southern part of Italy and were brought over for this particular purpose, who were extremely difficult to dislodge, and there were a lot of casualties.
You were still commanding at that time the headquarters company, were you?
Yes. Yes, the adjutant was a chap called Ken Kershaw, who was killed shortly afterwards.
Do you remember any aspects of the fighting?
I remember our second in command was a man called Hugh Blackton, who went up towards the German position, which was a slit, which was a ditch running off the main road, where the Germans were entrenched, and it was christened Stench Alley because of the smell of the dead bodies and the dead cows and animals around the place. And the Germans were in there, and eventually they did surrender. But Hugh Blackton had been up to see the position, and he'd been wounded. He got shot in both arms. I remember him walking back down to the head office, to the battalion headquarters. At the same time, the CO had gone to a brigade as the brigadier, I think, had been slightly wounded, and Bob Lidwell went to take command of the brigade, which has left myself in command of the battalion. However, the Germans came back. The Germans surrendered the remains of the remnants of the parachute regiment, about 100 of them, and they were marched away. Then we were to be relieved by the 9th Battalion, who were behind us. And their CO and second in command came to discuss the time, etc., of this relief. The CO was had been, Andrew Clark, had been a peacetime adjutant before the war, and he was a regular KOSB. His second in command was an old TA member of the 9th Battalion called Bill Robinson, who I had known in peacetime, and we were discussing the timing, etc., and the moves of this takeover. I had John Laybourne with me, and suddenly a mortar shell came over and hit both Andrew Clark and Bill Robinson. Andrew Clark had fell, and I rushed to him, and all I could see was he had a tiny wound in his chest, right up in his heart. And all he said was, "My God, they've got me," and he died straight away. Bill Robinson was hit in the thigh, and he was rushed into an ambulance, but they couldn't stop the blood escaping from his main artery, and he died in the hospital van on the way back to the casualty station. So this was a tremendous tragedy to lose both of them in one fell swoop. We were, John Laban and I were extremely lucky because neither of us were touched in this.
What had your responsibility been as CO for however temporary of the 8th?
Well, just to receive the orders of what to do with the next phase of the battle, what was to happen next.
And then pass them on?
Yes, to the company commanders, those who were left.
You took on lots of the battle?
Yes. Oh, yes, so there was just that particular time. There was nobody left. Because, as I said, the second in command had been wounded, and the CO was at brigade, so there was nobody else available.
What do you remember of the rest of the Sicily campaign?
It was a long, slow haul with going up the coastal road towards Messina. And it was a narrow road, and the Germans were experts at blowing bridges and mining the road, so you had to be very... And they left usually a few people behind who you had to be shifted first, and then, of course, you were up against the mining, and then you were up against the engineers filling up the road and making it... putting a temporary bridge across, where one had to get what they call a Bailey Bridge, or to allow us to get further advance, which, of course, was a long and tedious business, because you couldn't go quickly, because you never knew what was round the next corner.
Now, the 8th had been through quite a lot now. Well, what was morale like in the battalion coming up to the end of the Sicily campaign before you withdrew to...
The morale of it, I think, was pretty high.
They weren't battle-weary, then?
Not at that stage, no. I don't think we were, really. We sensed that the Battle of Sicily would be over fairly soon, and one's morale was pretty good at that time. We were then... we got as far as Taormina, which was a delightful spot, a famous resort that had been and is now still. And we had a talk by Monty in an amphitheatre, a Roman amphitheatre, which was a magnificent setting, with a view right across to Mount Etna. And it really was most good. And the other side was the Mediterranean and the beach down below. Delightful place. There we were slightly pulled back.
What was Montgomery saying?
He was telling us what the way things had gone, and saying wherever he went, he would take the 50th Division with him.
How did you feel about that?
Well, there was a loud groan from the troops as he said this, and he said, well, of course, even if I might even be going to England, and then there was a great cheer when they said that, which of course did turn out, but little did we know at that particular time what was happening. So we were then left on our own peacefully. We didn't go into Italy. We was then we had to wait for shipping to be organised to take us back to England. As the news came that we were to go back with Monty, as he'd said. So it was a very pleasant time indeed, because we did nothing but else but swim most of the day. We were near the beach, and just very pleasant indeed to have nothing really to do, and just waiting for the orders to come for the embarkation back home. So we were lucky in that extent. We came back.
I believe there was an incident on the voyage back. Can you remember it? At the cabin door.
Yes.
You want to tell that story?
Well, there was a certain incident at my cabin door when some enthusiasts were determined to get me out of bed. I decided it was time I had gone to bed. I locked my door. I knew what was going to happen, or that they were going to come and drag me out. As it was that stage of the evening, seemed to be the sensible thing, the thing to do, to go around and anybody who was in bed to drag them out and take them.
This was after a drinking party.
It was after a party, yes. And this was after we were quite a way back home by then. Then suddenly my door was shattered and a foot appeared through the door, which I had to get out of bed and help whoever put his foot through the door, because it was stuck and he couldn't get it out. So I managed to get them away, and I retired back to bed, and the next morning the steward, or one of the stewards, came round, saw this, and he held his hands up in horror and disappeared. And the next thing was that I was wheeled before the ship's captain and brought on a charge for damaging the cabin door, for which I was fined the sum of £5, which I totally had to pay. But fortunately, those responsible all tipped in, so I have still got the receipt from the master of the... That was not on that one. It was on the Daneira, that was, when we were in the Gulf of Aqaba, I think this was. It doesn't matter.
What happened when you got back to England then?
We were then, of course, we landed in Gourock in a rainstorm, raining heavily, which of course meant the dockers didn't work. They wouldn't unload the ship. So after having been abroad for 2.5 years, you could imagine what the comments of the troops were about the dockers. They were told in no uncertain terms that they didn't stop fighting because it rained, or words to that effect. However, we got to the... We were sent down to the village of Haverhill in Suffolk. And then we had leave, came back to Haverhill, and went on various training exercises in Eastern Command. We were under Eastern Command then.
Were there any new techniques being brought in that you've had?
Well, we were then, of course, in this stage of the training for the invasion. And, of course, we did one exercise up in Southwold, where there was the experimental work being done on flail tanks, and tanks which were able to travel in the sea and land, and being which were incredible sights to see, all these various ideas they had. And we saw we went up there for a week or so, a fortnight, where incidentally we were bombed Southwell, I think, had a first stick of bombs down there. I think it was a plane which had been driven away, been shot at, and he dropped a stick of bombs and dropped it down. And this was at night time, actually. Well, there were no casualties, though some buildings were damaged on the front. The troops were in some of these hotels on the front. And fortunately, we hadn't any casualties. From there, we then went south down to the New Forest. And camps. We were in a camp outside of Southampton called Nightingale Wood, which is full of nightingales. And where we remained, and we were then what was called sealed in after the when we knew the invasion time was coming.
What did it? Can you explain what that meant?
That we were not allowed out of the camp. We were there for good. Until we embarked, there was no leave, nothing.
Did you find that irksome?
Well, I suppose there was an awful lot to do, and we didn't. I think a lot. Well, we suffered a lot of people went away on. They deserted. But as a matter of fact, they all came back again. When they knew the D-Day was operative.
So it was more absent without leave.
Absent without leave, yes. There was quite a number of that. Because we were inspected. It was interesting. Inspected by everybody you could think of, the divisional commander, the corps commander, the army commander. Monty, of course, came. The king came, inspected us all. And then we had another inspection. We didn't know who it was. No idea, we weren't told. And we were then drawn up in these squares awaiting the inspection. The usual thing, of course, you got in the squares at about 8:30 in the morning or so, and about 10:30 the general arrived, whoever was coming. So you're standing there doing nothing, getting bored stiff. And who should come but one great big car arrived, and with one man inside, and no outriders, not the way Monty had come. These posse of outriders, etc. And out of this car stepped Eisenhower, who then did a Monty, called everybody around and proceeded to address the troops. This stage, the troops were bored stiff and had all this so many times before. But, you know, at the end of this speech that Ike gave, the troops burst into spontaneous applause, which was a tremendous praise of the man, and the personality, his personality had got across to the troops. And they were a bored and bolshy lot in those days, that particular time, and to a man have got a spontaneous applause out of that sent a tremendous amount
of... What was it they liked?
Well, I think it's just his general speaking, plain, factual. I can't remember what he said, but I mean it did.
What was the topic?
The morale and the object of this war and the campaign we were going to and what we had to do. And it really did get across. He had you could feel his personality. A very big man, I think, at that particular time.
Now you're moving now towards the actual invasion. Mm. What do you remember?
I remember standing on the quay waiting to get aboard. We were going over on American landing craft infantry, LCIs, and standing there, who should come along, but there was Winston Churchill, Ernie Bevan, Field Marshal Smuts, and can't remember who else was there. Churchill with his great big cigar, and all he was going right, passed by with tears running down his cheeks. God bless you boys, God bless you boys, as he walked on smoking a cigar, which didn't altogether improve our morale. I thought, my God, what are we up to, what are we in for? However, we got on, and of course it was on off. We didn't know whether it was to be on or off, but we went, we got over, and no problems. It wasn't too rough. and we were the follow-up brigade, the 69, which was the assault brigade. We were the follow-up brigade, so that we didn't have very much trouble at all. We were lucky. Got off the LCIs onto the beach, and
where would your carriers and such like of your company be?
They were on a, well, of course, they were on a one of the these flat-bottomed boats. The fronts came down.
Time.
No, they weren't with us, but they eventually turned up. They were on these big, like, you know, boats with ramps.
What happened on landing then?
And we got, we landed, and we got. I think the only casualty we had was the doctor. He was the only man wounded on the landing. But he wasn't badly wounded. Then we got ashore, and then it was all a bit vague after that. I can't remember a good deal. We pushed on eventually, and we got to Bahia. Just gradually moved on with frequent shellings and attacks by the Germans.
Do you remember any particular battle or incident?
Not at that, no, I don't really remember very much about that.
Do you know what the morale of the battalion was like?
The morale of the battalion was pretty good. I remember the brigadier was... The brigadier senior was captured and wounded on the first day on landing. Shortly after landing, how he did manage to, he escaped and got away. He died the other day. Poor chap, he went... I think he went gaga. Nice chap, he was a wonderful man. T.A. Brigadier, the Queen's Regiment.
So you moved into France?
We moved into France, and then we were in what was called the Bocage country, which was entirely different from anything we ever experienced. Small fields with lots of animals. Cows, etc., very rich countryside, and four hedges and small fields. And it was very difficult because the Germans got themselves in a machine gun post in the field, and it was very difficult to find out where they were. And of course, it was very difficult to shift because he could retire away and come back again. And it was a dangerous country to fight in because the Germans had a great advantage. There was little mobility. Then you had to be, it was a hard slog on your feet. And you couldn't move, and you couldn't get transport up very easily at all. So this was this long slog, and we were about, I suppose we were over 30 days before we were able to move forward to any great extent. And by this time, of course, morale was, we were very, very tired. We'd been at it for 30-odd days with no rest and no nothing, all in the front line all the time. And this was wearing, and as we were getting round to these places like Villas Bocage and Hotter and various places, that which were held by the Germans, of course they had their tanks there. And there were these big tanks beginning to appear, these Tiger tanks, which... we couldn't deal with because we hadn't got a guns capable of doing this, of coping with these tanks at that stage. Though we were beginning to get a few bigger, we got 6-pounder guns then, and we had eventually got these 17-pounders, which were much better.